It over to the chairperson. We want to thank you all who are coming into Theosophy Hall to help us in an effort to maintain a fragrance-free zone for the benefit of those with sensitivities, and also to remind all that on Zoom, it's important to recall the ULT declaration. Our meetings maintain anonymity, offer no crosstalk or side issues or personal anecdotes. Participants speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. These are traditions designed to welcome all to the study of philosophy, the philosophy of Theosophy, without distractions of any social differentiations or personal attributes. Let us all work to maintain these declared traditions.
Well, good morning. We'll begin here with the United Lodge of Theosophists Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It holds that the unassailable basis for union, it regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, to carry out the purposes of the declaration, the ULT here in Philadelphia carries out meetings on a weekly basis. On a Sunday morning such as now, the meeting is held both at the lodge at 1917 Walnut and on Zoom. Today's talk is on Hypatia, the last of the Neoplatonists. The Sunday talks always are from 11 to 12, and the doors open at 10:30 a.m. On Wednesday nights, right now we're just finishing up the Bhagavad Gita, and then soon our Wednesday night class will be the Ocean of Theosophy. The lodge is sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, money, and effort. All contributions are gratefully received, but there is no obligation imposed or implied. And we did mean to say that the Wednesday night meetings, should you choose to come to the lodge, the doors open at 6:15. The lodge meeting begins at 7:30 at the lodge and online, goes from 7:30 to 8:45. Now, today we have a panel discussion on Hypatia, who was the last of the Neoplatonists. We will have two presentations and then plenty of time for discussion and questions afterward. So just to back up a little bit, since the beginning of the summer, we've investigated during our Sunday meetings, we've investigated the presentment of the wisdom religion to the world publicly at a particular cycle. What was that cycle? Well, the cycle began during the 5th and 6th centuries BCE, before the Common Era, when we had on the scene during those couple of centuries all of Pythagoras, Lao Tzu, the Buddha, Zoroaster, Confucius, and Plato, all right around the same, within a century or two of each other. So something was going on big in the world at the time, probably behind the scenes. And there probably were many others on the scene as well, putting forth the effort. So this summer, we followed the line that descended from Pythagoras to Plato to the Neoplatonists of Alexandria, Egypt, with her influence all over the world. Now, let's remember, the secret doctrine is one. Yet it is up to the people receiving the message as to how it is applied, practiced, how deep it will be understood. And it's also up to the people receiving the message in any particular cycle as to whether it will be preserved among them by their work and kept before the public during any particular era. So before we get to Hypatia, the last of the Neoplatonists, it may prove helpful to imagine what was transpiring during that particular time in that space, as its ripple of effect would stretch over the whole of the Roman Empire and for many centuries into the future. We found this little golden nugget of a paragraph in the Secret Doctrine, which talks about that cycle, a period of 1,000 years that goes from the time of Pythagoras, Plato, and Buddha, and the others, 1,000 years from that time to the fall of the Neoplatonic school with the death of Hypatia. And HPB refers to that millennium as the bright millennium of history. As real occultism, she says, as real occultism had been prevalent among the mystics during the centuries that preceded our era, occultism among the mystics was prevalent that preceded our era, so too, magic or sorcery with its occult arts followed the beginning of the Christian era. However zealous the fanatical efforts during those early centuries of Christianity's to obliterate every trace of labor of the pagans, and when she talks about the pagans, she's talking about the ancient wisdom and the mystery schools, it was a failure to obliterate them. But the same spirit of that dark demon of bigotry and intolerance has pervaded systematically ever since every bright page written in the pre-Christine periods. Even in her uncertain records, history has preserved enough of that which has survived to throw an impartial light upon the whole. She says fragments have survived, fragments of the ancient wisdom have survived geological and political cataclysms to tell the story. And every survival shows evidence that the now secret wisdom was once the one fountainhead, the ever-flowing perennial source at which were fed all its streamlets, the later religions of all nations from the first down to the last. Now she's talking about that time at the beginning of the millennium. Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, the teachings of Pythagoras and Plato, all of this came, all of this began. That was the fount that she's talking about. This period, beginning with Buddha and Pythagoras at the one end, and the Neoplatonists and the Gnostics at the other, is the only focus left in history wherein converge for the last time the bright light streaming of the eons of time go on, which converse for the last time the bright rays of light streaming from eons of time unobscured by the hand of bigotry and fanaticism. So with the fall of Alexandria, that millennium, that cycle was done. Well, so what's going on then? Come the fourth century of the Common Era, Christianity took the form, or was in the process of taking the form, of a theocracy. This was referred to as the unholy marriage of the church and state. Now, when exactly that all happened, we can't get into the personalities and the dates, but this was what was going on. Early on, Christianity had become very much a strong political organization and was growing in influence. It throttled the old religions, HPV says, and the church becomes a temporal power. Roman heads of states, politicians, wealthy families of power, and we're not getting into names and all, but personalities are, played eventual conquering of the Western mind. These are all personalities that eventually conquered the Western mind under the form of organized Western religion. A student who studies these centuries, if you want to jump into it, will find emperors that are following psychic visions. One believed that he was to raise a crucifix in the name of the church with the inscription IHS, like to have a flag, in this sign we shall conquer in the name of Christ. Some of the emperors would claim that Christ spoke to them in dreams. One would refuse baptism and instead just live a murderous, sinful life until he was near death. And then he would accept baptism, confess his sins from God, and know that he's going to heaven because of this falsified religion. This was Constantine, and he was the first of all the emperors to become a Christian. During these times, people were forced to forget their own ancient traditions. They would have to accept Christianity based on an edict, or their meeting place and their homes would be demolished. According to Emperor Julian, many were imprisoned and persecuted and driven into exile. They were styled as heretics, and many were massacred. Entire villages were laid to waste and destroyed. In time was ordered the destruction of all the writings, adverse to the Christian faith. A great wave of psychism during the time of Constantine engulfed the whole Christian world. It was the age of miracles, of relic worship, and necromancy. This is a time in the Roman world, in the Roman / Christian world, before an accepted canon was agreed upon. They didn't have the Bible yet. A large number, however, of quote-unquote authentic manuscripts as regards the life of Christ and his teachings, a large number of them were in circulation, none of which were written by Jesus Christ or by any of his apostles. But the church had finally to decide which of these books, which of these gospels in circulation were to be accepted as authentic. And so tradition has it that in all of the 40 Gospels under the consideration, submitted to a group of bishops, how did they decide to do this? It is said that they put all of these books under a communion table in church. The bishops besought to God that the inspired readings of all these books might get upon the table while the spurious ones remained underneath. And they left the building. The next morning, when the bishops returned, the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were resting on the communion table. So this is the nature of what was going on in that world at the time. As regards the teachings of the church, the problem was that the church had borrowed too much from the pagans or from the mystery religions. Every event in the life of Jesus, from his virgin birth to his final crucifixion and resurrection, had been copied from stories of pagan gods. Every dogma, every ritual in the Christian church had its pagan counterpart. Because of this, it had become more and more difficult for the church to convince people that it was unique and it alone was the path to God. So, if the pagan schools, which were the mystery schools that we talk about, if the mystery schools continued to exist, the church would not be the sole repository of knowledge, so they had to go. So long as pagan books existed, the Bible would not be accepted as the only revelation of God. So that had to go. So long as philosophers freely taught the dogmatic of the assertions of the church fathers would always be questioned. So they had to go. There was but one course for the church, and it was to destroy all evidence of the church's plagiarisms by wiping out the pagan schools, the pagan records, and the pagan philosophers themselves. The first move was directed against the schools, the mystery schools, and their destruction was accomplished. There's one story of one of the schools which attempted to resist. It was a great school called the Eleusinian School in Athens. And there's a story to it. We couldn't get into all of it, but it was doomed to destruction. This vast temple of Eleusis, the Eleusinian mystery, one of the most famous buildings in the world, the outer court of which could hold 300,000 people, was reduced to ruins. So perished the mysteries of Greece, we are told. Well, once that was done, eyes were turned toward Alexandria. Alexandria, for centuries, had been the cultural center of the world. The great museum in Alexandria had already been put under the control of a Catholic priest during the reign of Constantine, but the vast group of buildings known as the Serapeum was still in the hands of the pagans. At that time, the magnificent Temple of Serapis was being used as a university where the old religions and sciences were still being taught. The library of the Serapeion still housed the vast collections of books which had been brought from the four corners of the earth and which represented the intellectual labor of many centuries. Both of these repositories of pagan knowledge were obstacles in the path of the church. And Theodosius at the time determined that his reign would witness the destruction of these institutions in Alexandria. So this is a background of what was going on. We'll turn it to our other panelists who will give some insights into Hypatia, the last of the Neoplatonists.
Yes, in a time of turmoil, we find Hypatia around. It's stated that she was born in 355, 370, and that she died in 415, 414. The exact dates are not known. But between 45 and 60, when she died. And when you look in the dictionary or an encyclopedia, it uses the word girl, girl astronomer and philosopher. So who was this girl that was living at this time? Well, her father was Theon, who was a very famous philosopher at that time. And it's said that he was perhaps the last attendant member of the Alexandrian Museum, which was the more or less the university before it was closed. But Theon was her father, and he had a daughter who he raised and taught her, and she became one of his most brilliant students. And what happened was that she was very articulate and very pleasing to look at. In fact, we found a reference to her in a 10th century encyclopedia. And it states this about Hypatia: exceedingly beautiful, fair of form, in speech articulate and logical, in her actions prudent and public spirited, and the rest of the city gave her suitable welcome and accorded her special respect. Now, this was an account. So what Hypatia became a teacher, and she spoke openly in the public square. But she also spoke in the last remaining elements of that, we would say, out of the university or the museum, is that what she did is she used logic and understanding, and she was openly explaining how the church had borrowed all these rituals from the pagan religions. And this was part of her public speaking. So she was exposing the lies that were being perpetrated by the church. Well, as it being that she was so well loved and respected, she was invited to many of the wealthiest homes and the most powerful in the city. And one of her patrons was Orestes. He was the governor of Alexandria. And Alexandria, during this time, there was a lot of turmoil, a lot of conflict. The Jews had been expelled from Alexandria. There was fighting amongst the pagans and the Christians. And this was being fueled by the archbishop, who had been a nephew of the governor, and then when the governor had, the archbishop had died, Cyril, his name was, took charge, and he was very hostile to any other form of religion, and he became head of the city. But there was that conflict that Orestes did not want to succeed as civil power to the church. So there was a conflict. So this is what the time when Cyril expelled all the Jews and looted their homes and their temples. You know, Orestes protested to Rome about this. But Orestes refused any reconciliation from Cyril. So Cyril's monks try to assassinate Orestes. But because he was well guarded by his soldiers, the attempt failed. So in retaliation, Cyril started a rumor that the reason there was no reconciliation was because of Hypatia, because of what she was teaching. And then a horde of Cyril's personal monks that had tried to assassinate Orestes led upon Hypatia after one of her sessions where she was teaching. And she was leaving the temple, getting onto her chariot. The mob rushed her chariot and pulled her from it, stripped her of her clothing, dragged her into the temple, and murdered her. And it said, you know, in a very horrific way, that they scraped the flesh from her body with shells. So perhaps the worst of humanity was shown here. But this murder began, or was the closing of that great line of the mysteries, of the mystery school, of this ancient teaching that had expanded time. And now these teachings are again put in the light of humanity. They have been written down. So again, we see a light that was brutally snuffed out. But what did Hypatia stand for? What was it that, what values or anything did she impart? But she obviously was a woman, and women were treated very badly in that time. So she stood out as an example, and that she was virtually the last academic. She stood for intellectual values. She stood for rigorous mathematics. She stood for being an ascetic Neoplatonist. And she understood and she taught that the crucial role of the mind must be recognized. And she was always the voice of temperance and moderation in civic life. So she was the last light of this pagan religion, this universal religion, this universal theosophy. As mentioned, we've been trying to show the path that this light has taken. And we as students tried to keep that light alit. So we think we have, yes, and Hypatia did invent what was called an astrolabe, which was a portable astronomical calculator. She was an astronomer. Her father was a follower and wrote many commentaries on Euclid. And if you look into mathematics and look into that science, it has a way of expanding the mind and making us think in other directions. So she was an exponent of rigorous mathematics. And that would just be a reminder to all of us that it does make us think in other ways. And I think we have, the only thing we can add is that when we come across the great mathematicians, one of the sayings of Euclid was, the whole is always greater than its parts, which was somewhat of a revelation to many. So we'll depart here. We cannot cover this subject completely because we've been doing it for weeks. And all this melts together in one idea, and that is theosophy. So any questions or any comments?
So?
So even though Hypatia represents the end of a cycle, apparently it was also, through her efforts and teachings, the beginning of a new cycle, which continued, as we understand, for several hundred years, perhaps not as public, maybe more underground, maybe more scattered, until the 13th century. When we see it becoming more public again. So it would seem as though that there were still individuals who took that knowledge and in their own way preserved it or had their own students. Any evidence of that you've seen in your research?
Yes, I think one of these manifestations were the Cathars in France. They were a community of pagans or theosophists that had understood the teachings of Plato and Pythagoras, and how that there was that man was perfectible, and that we were spiritual beings. And this again, I think it was several hundred years later, after Hypatia, that these communities arose, but it was stamped out or destroyed by the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Every person was, annihilated or assassinated by the Church. So I think we see communities popping out even throughout our modern day of where spiritual inspiration has brought them together as a community.
JD.
Yes. We're talking about the origins of Neoplatonism, and I'm curious about Hermeticism. It seems that was a philosophy and school that was kind of taking place at the same time in Alexandria. Can we talk about that a little bit, the origins and how that may have affected or interplayed with the Neoplatonism? And was Hermeticism also kind of coming to an end at Hypatia, or was it, something that continued on or along those lines, please?
So the question is, where does Hermeticism fit into this? And it's our understanding that goes back to Egypt, that's for sure. Exactly how it played out in Alexandria, we couldn't really say. But our understanding is during the Renaissance, Hermeticism was something that very much bubbled to the fore. So it's got to have something in common with the wisdom religion, the principles of it. Is there someone else who has insight into that, SL, please?
The Hermetic tablets or teachings were said to have been revealed by Hermes, a prominent personage in the Egyptian line of teachers. The thing is, though, that at that time, the term Hermes could not necessarily refer to one individual, but a line of teachers. And it seems as what happened around after the time of Alexandria's fall, that many people copied or changed or adapted these ideas to their own liking, but attached their name to it to give it sort of credence. And so what we saw later arising, as was said in the Renaissance, were these Hermetic tablets, which were not necessarily the original teachings, but were suffused with different elements and sort of similar to what happened with the writings of Theosophy put forward by HPB. Changes were made and things were called Theosophy, which were not Theosophy, but that was apparently what happened with the Hermetic line of teachings.
Thank you.
It seems that happens with most lines of teachings, if not all.
Well, what's helpful to realize here is the emphasis that was made that it was in the fourth century as a public expression. It was done, and it was done until the modern day Theosophical movement was founded. Now, of course, that's not to say that it wasn't still among the people. Sub Rosa, there were organizations throughout Europe, whatever the right word is, and it bubbled up over the course of time through the Renaissance and onward, even among the German priests in the you think the 13th, 14th, 15th century, which eventually came about with the Reformation.
But we see it bubbling up in our present day and age, the formation of this country. You know, the founding fathers, I mean, they were deists, they weren't Christians, and Thomas Paine. I mean, there's a whole lineage of human beings that have professed these ideas in one way or another. And we see that the evolution, we are part of that evolution, you know, that these teachings are now public and written down, but they're only a fragment.
JD, and then Theosophy all.
HPB and the Theosophical movement, was there a vision or an idea of how far their work would expand into the future? Was there an idea of how much of an impact the movement would have and how long the writings and the teachings would remain relevant?
The question is, the teachings remain relevant. These teachings, if they are true, are always relevant. They do not change. What these teachings do is re-gives humanity a reflection of reality. What is reality? What is real? And then we begin our journey. You know, what is real? And we come to Theosophy, and Theosophy tells us what, or shows us what is real. And it's through spiritual knowledge, which is, you know, we have to educate ourselves because we are so imbued with the materialistic aspect of life that we struggle to attain a spiritual perspective, you know, and that is impersonal. You know, one of the main characteristics of these ideas is that they are impersonal. They apply to all of us, not just to a few. They're not, it's not exclusive, it's inclusive.
We'd like to add to that. So how long will theosophy in this cycle impact? Well, maybe we could think of it this way. In school, the young child who's learning addition and subtraction, whether he knows it or not, he's prepping his mind for calculus. And it's all a process, which is a building process. He has no idea even what calculus is, but as he learns the principles that are appropriate to his level of development, he's preparing himself for something in the future that right now he has no idea. Even into, you know, that path could lead him into quantum physics. We all know that. Well, we're told that reading the secret doctrine, you know, we can read the words on the paper. How well we understand what we're reading is another discussion. But as we read theosophy, we're actually prepping our inner nature or our higher mind for to be ready to receive yet more. And we're, so to speak, building a philosophical framework that will be there ready to support when we're ready to learn more. It's said that there's enough in the secret doctrine for the modern day human mind there's enough there for at least the next two centuries for where man is in his evolution right now. Yes, Theosophy Hall.
In time, what we've studied on Sundays the last couple months about the great theosophists and ancient landmarks, we realized that these ideas have gone back before the Common Era of the Pythagoras, and just as far back as we can record. So there's nothing to say that it can't go forward. We look at these ideas as being true, and we know that real truth is true no matter what period of time. There are cycles when it's free to be out in the open, such as now, but then in Hypatia's time, it became underground, but it's always there. The masters will always protect it and bring it forward when the time is right. And these are always the same ideas. And HPB talks about, there's no knowledge greater than truth, I think it is. And so these are the true ideas, and as such, they will always be around in some form.
SL?
In one of her articles, HPB says that theosophy will become the cornerstone of the religions of the future. And it makes us wonder what that means. One idea that comes to mind is that the religions of the future, if they have theosophy as their cornerstone, will be based more on the idea of brotherhood, the spiritual identity of all beings, scientific evidence, an understanding of the nature of the human being, and not so much on assumed revelation and dogma and force of belief. And we think we see evidences of that today, or the beginning of a dissatisfaction with any kind of dogmatism or prejudice, even if it's religious, that does not dignify humanity. or serves as a wedge between humanity. People are beginning to question more and think independently. So that has to have an effect on how people worship and revere the unity of life in the future.
Thank you. So the comment is that in one of HBB's articles, the statement is that theosophy will be the cornerstone of all religions of the future. Well, isn't that a restatement of what she says when, or in the Secret Doctrine, where it says that the presentment during the 5th and 6th century, that was the source of all of the world's religions at that time too. So it's kind of interesting, the paragraph that we had read. Yes, theosophical.
Well, just one more comment.
Oh, sure.
You know, this goes back to Ammonius Saccas, and where he tried to tie all religions together into one source. So, you know, it's the same thing. Go ahead, theosophical.
Just a little addition to one of the previous comments is that the news is always commenting about how different research has shown that more people are becoming dissatisfied with organized religion, that they don't like the dogma, they don't like the ritual, but that they still believe in some kind of a deity. So it's almost as if the cycle is turning, that people are beginning to realize that we don't need all the trappings in order to have a spiritual life.
Thank you. So, yeah, you know, what we'd have to add to that is, isn't it the case? All right. So not as many people go to church. People aren't really into organized religions. But isn't it the case? Gee whiz, they still have their God. It might be money. It might be, you know, they direct their energies into, you know, some people turn politics into a religion. Some people turn money into the religion of their life. So it's not like people lose the church and find, you know, more spiritual stuff. We've got to keep doing what we have to do to keep this in the public square, because like in Alexandria, it disappeared back then, and it was not seen by more than just the few for a long time until it resurfaced. So it's a real concern. We find it a concern that people are out there looking for something, and they're finding a lot of things. They're finding a lot of false gods, a lot.
Just to remind us all that we have to be the mouthpiece in our world in which we live for this philosophy. You know, how do we do that? How do we make this a living power in our life? What is the real meaning of theosophy? You know, we need just to take these ideas and slowly incubate them and let them diffuse our life. You know, we don't change in a moment, but we can, but we don't usually. It's a long process. Theosophy Hall.
Go ahead.
What was Hypatia's religion? Did she worship the god Serapis?
Did she worship Serapis? Did she have a religion? There's a question. Did Hypatia have a religion? As far as the state religion was the worship of the synthesis of the Greek and the Egyptian, the new myth of Serapis, and there was a temple to Serapis. We were just wondering if Hypatia, we think the question is, did Hypatia also give homage to this
Well, we haven't read whether or not she actually belonged to a particular religion. However, being a Neoplatonist at that level, now remember, the Neoplatonists didn't call themselves Neoplatonists. They called themselves Theosophists. That's the word that they used. And whereas Theosophy answers all of those questions that can ever be posed by someone in search of true religion, if one would say she had a religion, we think that just Neoplatonism would have been her religion. That's not to say she didn't attend some other practice, organization, because religion even today and back then was also social. There was a lot of things going on. But the emphasis there is Neoplatonism is very definitely a spiritual philosophy, just as Theosophy is the synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy. SL.
If we use that teaching of the 1500-year cycle, where groups of egos incarnate together, and we're saying that this all took place around the 4th, 5th century, in the Common Era, as we moved into the 19th and 20th century, it seems as that all those individuals, those souls under the influence of the spiritual teachings of Alexandria, the Neoplatonists, reincarnated in general, plus all the old tendencies and conflicts. It was talked about the turmoil in the Roman world at that time. Well, certainly we see turmoil in all levels of society in the 20th century, and the struggle of individuals to overcome bigotry and suppression of all kinds. And it's almost as if we are looking around and seeing those egos among us today on the street corner, at work, all that were very much affected and involved and in a different part of the world at that time. They incarnate together and some of that karma is experienced again.
Thank you. Well, certainly if the cycle of reincarnation, as we're taught, is generally 15 centuries, what is 15 centuries from the fall of Alexandria? It's the representation of Theosophy in an obviously appropriate forum, the freest country in the world, with the protections of keeping it free and people able to practice it and teach it freely without being harassed by the local government.
And it's stated that that would be around 1912 and, World War One that took place. So that, again, as was stated, a great conflict was occurring at that time, as was stated. Great turmoil, politically and spiritually. So we are seeing that today.
J.D.?
Yes, during the lecture, the point was made that at that time there was no Bible. And it's interesting to try to imagine how, the church could establish itself and the power and the influence that it had over, the happenings at that time without a Bible, without a set of writings. What was the methods that were used? I mean, was it ritual? Was it just word of mouth teaching? How did that take place?
So how did the rituals and the traditions of the church spread during those centuries if there was no Bible for it to spread? Well, that was a challenge. And part of the strategy of the Roman Empire was to get rid of all these different religions, because if we could get them all practicing the same religion and thinking the same thing, we can, because it was massive. The empire was massive at the time. And that actually, the roots of being a godmother or a godfather is exactly the answer of that question. Back then, the Godfather was someone faithful to the church who would go out into the land of the pagans, find a highly influential, probably a wealthy householder, a man who had servants and a large family and grandchildren, and for lack of a better word, sell him on the idea of Christianity. And if he could get Christianity into this one and influence that whole area, we'd make him a bishop. And the Godfather was responsible for the education of that whole clan to teach the common traditions of the church. So that was that. That's how they did it. That's where the Godfathers came from. And it's not like they just went to one. This was the methods that they used. They would find the wealthy people, sell them on Christianity. And if the owner of the household was turned Christian, everybody in the household was Christian. That's just that was a given. And that's how it was established. Yes, there was a hand.
Well, there's also, you know, I mean, the obvious way, a fear. Go ahead, SL.
So historically, we know, and we have the records of them, for several hundred years, there were a number of councils of Constantinople, councils, Nicaea. And this was primarily a gathering of the church authorities, bishops of the Eastern and Western Roman Empire, where it was decided what would be the teachings of the church. It had nothing to do with the Bible. And it's interesting, at the Council of Constantinople in the 5th century, that was the one where reincarnation was declared anathema, and not long afterwards, the doctrine of original sin became a cardinal teaching. Now, the idea was that if it specifically states in the council that if one taught, believed, tried to promulgate the idea of reincarnation or pre-existence of the soul, they would be declared anathema and excommunicated from the church, which not only ensured that they would not go to heaven, but that all their worldly goods could be confiscated. So it was a systematic control of the minds and the hearts of the people through those that they trusted, their spiritual authorities, but they had to believe. There was no other option.
That's rather to point of Hypatia. She was murdered in 415 AD. So you're talking about the same time, same period of time.
So, you know, what's a shame about all of this is that, think about it, you know, what we learn, what we read is that, okay, so the teachings of all the different mystery religions were put into the traditions of the Catholic Church. And, well, they're in all of the other mystery religions too. So it's not like it's owned by one. So the question would be, well, what's so bad about it being in the Catholic Church too? I mean, if they're establishing some kind of a religion, well, first of all, do they understand what they're dealing with? Do they understand the real teachings behind it? Or are they giving false ideas and assigning them to the symbols, you know? And that's the first problem. And the second problem is, unfortunately, even today, the Catholic Church tries to say that it's uniqueness, but there are so many teachings in the church that are found elsewhere that are just basic theosophical principles. What proves the validity of those particular Catholic teachings is that they are taught all over the world and since forever. Whereas the church will deny, no, it's only a Catholic teaching. And that's simply just not the case. And if they would recognize that, no, it's not unique. Uniqueness does not make it valid. What makes it valid is if it's universal. And of course, if the symbols and the stories are properly interpreted. And that's a whole other discussion. Yes.
Well, just one comment, Ed, is that the church also has its esotericists. And those esotericists have made many changes, many adaptations or alterations in the teachings. Sure. And they have distorted many of them. And they're known throughout history as the Black Robes. Hmm. So you figure that one out, who that is. The Jesuits.
Theosophy Hall?
Well, the Jesuits definitely get a lot of kudos in the conspiracy theory community. But some of it deserved and some of it, no doubt, exaggerated. But however, that's another, we don't argue about religious. That's the whole thing with religion, is arguing over how many angels are on the head of a pin. Yeah. So we don't even go there. But the Roman Catholic Church does have one claim to uniqueness. It's in the fact that they say they're unique.
So with that, we'll make a call there. We've come upon the hour, and it's certainly not the duty or the job for Theosophists to go around burning down Catholic churches, but to live one's life in such a way that might inspire questions and discussion in the hearts and minds of anybody and everybody who we may come across, and to be ready to help them point direction, to help them solve whatever problems they may have in their hearts and heads.
Be like Hypatia.
Thank you.